This episode has been brought to you by Sake Man, a group of sake superheroes bringing sake to the world.
Hey there, HRN listeners. This is Harry Rosenbloom, host of Feast Your Ears. I know that news about COVID-19 and the coronavirus has made a lot of people nervous about getting sick. This collective unease has already had a big impact on our restaurant and food communities, especially in New York's Chinatowns. We hope that now more than ever, our listeners will join us in supporting restaurants and the hospitality industry at large. Many of the restaurants we love are small, independent businesses. That means that even one or two bad weeks can put them in jeopardy of cutting staff, limiting hours, or even having to close for good. As long as we're still able, we should go out to eat and support our favorite restaurants. I think it's also great to remember that hospitality professionals are really good at hygiene and food safety practices. Long before there were guides all over the news about how to properly wash your hands, they were already experts at hygiene. Guests' health is tantamount to successful hospitality in any restaurant. And even if you don't want to go out, you can still support restaurants by ordering delivery, buying gift cards, and giving them some extra love on social media. What better way to handle a crisis than by supporting those in our own community? If we don't support them now, they might not be there when this crisis is over. Join HRN in supporting restaurants during this time, especially our friends in Chinatowns around the country. Thanks for listening.
So you don't shun the devil with your rock and roll load. Knows that country music's gonna save your soul. The devil runs his groove in them rhythm and blues. That's him. It's gonna get you some in the end.
Welcome back to the Speakeasy. I'm Souther Teague.
I'm Greg Benson.
Hey, Greg. How are you, bud?
I'm good, man. The world's on fire, but it's springtime in Brooklyn.
Well, not quite. Did you know March 21st, the solstice? Equinox. That's Amori Margo's 9th birthday.
What? Happy early birthday, man.
Yeah.
You guys, so it's the 9th anniversary of the that fun little bitters pop-up that's on 6th
yeah.
Street, right?
Still popping.
Haven't popped down yet.
Still popping hard. Yeah. Hard enough to open another one.
Congratulations, man.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Didn't even think of that until you said the word spring. Yeah. We don't celebrate that stuff. We just open up and do our business every day. That's our thing.
That's fair. Not going to have like a little cake made with like a shitload of Fernet Branca or something?
No.
A super bitter cake?
I call it the Mr. Rogers rule. I was a big fan of that show when I was a kid and even as an adult. And did you happen to see the very last episode of the Mr. Rogers show?
I think I did, but...
Do you know what he did at the very end of the very last show ever?
Couldn't tell you.
Yeah, he changed his shoes and his fucking sweater like every other fucking day.
There you go, man.
Right? So that's what we do. We just open up and do our thing every day. We don't celebrate our birthday, Christmas, New Year's. We just do our thing.
Sweet.
It's the Mr. Rogers rule. What have you been up to? I listened to your latest episode. It's amazing.
Oh, thank you, man. Thank you very much.
I think it's my favorite one so far.
I'm super proud of how that one turned out. I really like it.
Hemingway.
The Hemingway daiquiri. And not just because it's always fun to direct an actor playing Ernest Hemingway, which is always a blast, but just because there were such two very interesting, like intense but diametrically opposed personalities there behind that drink. It's kind of what happens when an unstoppable force meets an immovable object, mm-hmm. And it was just a real blast to work on.
Well, I'm not going to give anything away because I think people should go listen to it, but I like the conclusions that you came to at the end regarding the two gentlemen in question. It was a great episode.
Thank you, man. Appreciate
it. I really do enjoy Bar None Podcast, your show. It's great.
Available wherever fine podcasts are found.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's great.
Yeah, man. And we got an amazing lineup of bands in for, we just got the rest of the lineup set for the month at the Illegal pop-up that's on St. Mark's. Including every Friday, we have Tractor Supply Company in, which is a Delta Blues band that just murders it. And it's a ton of fun. Like last Friday, we were working. We were a little bit of a slow start because it was still cold and everybody's afraid. And we were a little bit concerned. And then it was one of these like 0 to 60. It's like 9 o'clock. It was pretty empty. 9:15 when the band started, full. Couldn't move. Literally could not move from behind the bar to the front door. Had to go around the back way to get anything that you possibly needed that wasn't within arm's reach.
Amazing.
Yeah, it was great. It's a good time.
Yeah, and that space is really fun when it's cranking.
Yeah, is it smaller than your bar, Souther?
I mean, you'd know better than I the square footage. It seems it. It's definitely thinner, but it might be longer.
Exactly.
So square footage wise, it might be similar, but it's, we're in competition for smaller.
Exactly. I'll bring a tape measure next time I'm working tomorrow, and we'll sort this out once and for all.
Cool. Well, let's talk to our guests. We got a lot of people in the studio today, so we've got plenty to talk about today. We're going to be hanging out with Matt Piacentini. Yes or no?
Yes.
All right, nice. Matt Piacentini, my dear friend, Chaim Dowerman, and my new friend, Allie Martin, from the Up and Up in, what's the neighborhood you're in?
Greenwich.
In Greenwich, yeah. And we're going to talk about a whole bunch of stuff that goes on over there. Welcome to the studio, guys.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Don't forget, it's radio. You can talk into the microphone. No one can see us, so you can't just nod your head. Happy to have you guys on. Up and Up is coming up on its fifth anniversary, speaking of anniversaries.
Already passed.
Oh, yeah, it did?
Yep.
Son of a bitch.
Yep.
I'm going to dig through my email. I must have missed my invite.
I mean, I guess it's a bit of a Mr. Rogers rule with us as well. I mean, we talked about it on social media, but we didn't do anything in the bar. We just, in fact, I didn't even tell anybody that it was the day until like 2 minutes before the end of the night. I don't even think the staff knew working that night.
Right. There's also a little bit of internal back and forth about what the actual day is, whether or not you count soft opening.
I feel like bars aren't human beings. You know, you can kind of flub that number. I'm pretty sure if I really dug hard into the data, I think Amore opened on the 17th. I think we opened on St. Patrick's Day. But we sort of call it the 21st as the
It's more like opening week.
For us. Something like that. I do remember seeing your social media regarding the fact that the drink that was named after me is no longer on the menu.
It's true. In fact, I just found out we don't even have the flasks to flask it up anymore.
Oh, man.
I wanted to flask something up to bring here. But, we can't even make it if we wanted to.
God, I forgot we did that. Naming drinks after bartenders.
Yeah, we had a whole menu of bartender-named drinks.
Oh, then I don't feel so bad anymore. I thought I was the only one.
Well, there were only three or four.
Yeah, all right.
And yours was the only one in a flask.
Honestly, we wanted to serve that drink, and then we came up with a section of the menu just to justify.
That's actually true.
There we go. Well, that makes me feel better. Well, cool, guys. Tell the listener about the Up and Up, because we talked before the show. You haven't been on the show since before the Up and Up existed.
Long before
2013, yeah. You were on the show last.
I was here, yeah,
with Damon. Mm-hmm. So talk about the Up and Up. Tell us what it's all about. What the message is,
Matt. Well, the Up and Up is a really intimate little cocktail den down in a basement on rowdy Gros McDougal Street in Greenwich Village. sort of an oasis away from the sights, smells, sounds. One of the last areas of Manhattan that's still pretty like it was in the late 70s. The space actually used to be the Gaslight Cafe.
Famous.
Yeah. And then after that, it was the Scrap Bar, which is in that neighborhood and almost more famous than the Gaslight was. But
well, the Gaslight's where like a lot of cool 60s bands played, right?
Yeah, Dylan has an album, Live at the Gaslight, in 66, yeah. But the point of the Up and Up is just supposed to be a really nice place to go get a really great cocktail in a really nice space and kind of not be overly bothered by anything else than good drinks, good company.
Yeah. And you're pretty well versed in that sort of communication of message, because you have a hand in a really well known bar on the West Coast too, right?
Clyde Common. Yeah, Clyde Common. That's right.
Which is constantly winning awards.
For sure, yeah, it's great.
So I'm sure you guys are sort of striving for the same sort of sense of place and sense of service.
Yeah, I mean, at the Clyde, it's a little more anything goes, because it's also just a big restaurant, all the communal tables. Up and Up's very much a seated, you know, more sort of intimate service style, but the same amount of kind of not taking yourself too seriously and just kind of letting the product speak for itself.
How does that go over in that neighborhood? You know, I'm over in the East Village, and I'm nine doors down from Death and Company, and they hold the door, right? 48 seats means 48 people, and then the door gets held. And you guys do the same program over there, which is much more, I think, busy, lots of folks on the street, like... Is there blowback? I mean, 5 years in, you're probably adjusted to it, but like, do you get blowback?
Oh, for sure. I'll actually let Chaim talk about that, because he's the one who really came up with the whole door protocol.
Yeah, at first it was a little awkward when we opened 5 years ago, because people didn't know we were there, and people who went to McDougal Street to look for bars weren't really familiar with the kind of bar that we were. We were encountering people who had never heard of a cocktail bar, had never heard of the idea of a seated-only bar, could never imagine the idea of a wait list to get into a bar. So there would be times where we were almost empty and we're having to turn away something that might be a 15 top, but they couldn't really tell us for sure. And it was tough. But now that our reputation is there, and honestly, we're hard enough to find that people don't accidentally find us anyway. We really, it's sort of, it's a refuge for people who live in the neighborhood who just want a nice place. It's a stopover for people who come to the neighborhood for a specific purpose, whether it's to have dinner at Minetta Tavern or whether it's to go to a show at the Comedy Cellar. They know that we're there and we become an essential part of that sort of
a little ecosystem that's going on. Yeah.
So I think that we've succeeded in being kind of an exception on McDougal as far as what kind of experience people are going to have.
I mean, it's pretty amazing. I didn't even think of that. You're just down the street from Minetta. You're kind of right on top of the Comedy Cellar. You're just around the corner from what's it called, Black Cat, the music venue, right? Like that that area is like a little, you know, it's got something for everyone.
Mm-hmm. It attracts a lot of people.
So I feel like that's just that statement makes it seem like that it fits in, right? It's something for everyone. So
I think
you're for the person who wants a little bit more reserved, maybe quiet experience.
Yeah, I think that's a big part of its success is, and it's something that really, I think we came to realize long after the fact as to why the bar works so well there, is that that area is surrounded by so many different types of people doing so many different types of things that the actual audience around there is super broad, is where other neighborhoods that we've had bars in have had really, you know, a homogenous kind of group of people that are all looking for the same thing. And if you're not exactly that, there's really just not enough support.
Mm. But how do you, so I'm the opposite, right? You guys have all been to my bar. Maybe some of the listeners have been there as well. We never hold the door. We pack that place like sardines. I tell people it's like bartending on the L train at 8 a.m. on a Monday morning. Always, right? And that's a choice I made because I want the room to seem like a party. I want the room to seem like boisterous and full at all times. And also, I'm a business. I want the money. Like, how do you, as a business operator, justify saying, I'm going to not let people stand. I'm going to hold the door.
Well, it's a hard decision to make.
Yeah.
Leaving
money on the table.
In the early days, when we were maybe really slow midweek, it was kind of hard. There were times where, and this is before Ali joined us, and there were times where Matt and I would look at each other and we'd be like, you know, if it's like this in another 4 months, we might have to turn this into a different kind of place. Because it's hard to keep people out.
Yeah.
But what we planned for and what we wanted is to attract Tuesday drinkers. We wanted to attract people who aren't just weekend warriors, but are going out to a bar is a part of how they live their everyday life. It's a place where they want to get together with a friend, where they want to bring their family. And we wanted to be the kind of place that's welcoming to that kind of person who's not looking for a party. And our goal and our hope was that if we provided a place where the busiest moment on a Saturday was indistinguishable from the busiest moment on a Monday from the guest's perspective, that we would create a ambiance that was consistent enough that people would feel comfortable trying to stop by any day. And in the long term, that strategy, I think, has been rewarded by the fact that we're on a wait basically every night.
Yeah. And that's great. I mean, I think, and you didn't have to crack the egg. You just had to make the omelet, right? There's plenty of bars that have already set this precedent, especially here in New York City, where there's, you know, we hold the door, we get to a certain level, and we hold the door. I think that's great, right? You create an environment where I think I can say to myself, or I can point guests who ask me for that sort of experience towards you, right? You want something that's like, I can still have an intimate conversation with whomever I'm with. It's not going to be crazy loud. There's not going to be people behind me bumping into me, passing drinks, money, menus over me. Mm-hmm.
And if someone says to one of us, hey, you know, why aren't there more people here? Where's the louder music? Can you turn that music up? Can you put this song on? We're able to say, you know, that's just not what we do. It's not what this bar is, because we know that there are more than enough people who come to us for what we are, that we can make those decisions.
Yeah.
And, you know, granted, the decision to be that kind of place was really made by the guests more than it was made by us. When sure. we were building it, the design was because of McDougal Street. We didn't know exactly how people were going to take it. We wanted to be ready to go the other way if that's what it was going to be. There was a lot of open space. We had, you know, things like vodka sodas on tap, a lot more beer, you know, and if that's what people would have wanted, then we maybe wouldn't have the sort of door seated only policy. But it became obvious, like from day one, people wanted cocktails. Everyone wanted the thing that took the longest time to make, that required the highest level of service, and responding to them is why we decided, okay, no standing room, seated only. So really the people decided what kind of bar.
Yeah, I always say plan your work your plan, and be flexible, meaning you can set up everything the exact way you want it, but when the guests come in, they're going to tell you what they want, right?
We were definitely ready to pivot, and when we opened, we expected that our cocktail sales would maybe make up about 60% of our sales. And from day one, it's been 90. And
that's incredible. The
first couple of weeks, we were really eye-opening for us because we had a lot of heavy hitters in the industry coming through, a lot of cocktail nerds coming through. It was the response to our bar was hitting a very specific niche, a specific type of guest. And a kind of very specific sort of intellectual headspace within the industry. And I think that definitely formed what we very quickly became. And the door, how the door is run, the seated only aspect of it is something that grew up around being able to provide the experience that people had said they wanted from us.
Sure, at least expressed that they wanted in some way. Well, that's great. All right, this is a great time to take a quick break and hear from our sponsors. We'll be right back, and we'll keep talking to the team from the Up and Up. We're gonna get we got some stuff on the table. Looks like Allie's gonna make us some drinks.
Ooh.
So we'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Sake Man. What is Sake Man? Sake men are judo athletes wearing Lucha Libre-inspired masks that act as sake heroes. This team of athletes moonlight as sake educational professionals spreading sake to the world. Learn more about their mission and their favorite sakes at saketotheworld.com. That's saketotheworld.com.
And we're back. Welcome back to the Speakeasy on Heritage Radio Network. We're hanging out with the team from Up and Up in Greenwich Village. Allie, looks like you got some drinks over there to make for us.
Yeah.
And your position at the Up and Up is head bartender, yeah?
Uh-huh.
How long have you been there?
I've been at the Up and Up for 3 years.
Almost.
Almost.
Definitely met.
Oh, yeah.
Almost 3 years, yeah.
All right, cool. So what'd you bring for us? Talk to us about it.
I have the Mezcal Safe Cracker, so kind of a Negroni variation. Campari, Mezcal, Ancho Reyes, Verde. So a little green, a little earthy, a little bitter.
And the Safe Cracker, I feel like that name sounds familiar. Has that one been on for a while?
Yeah.
Because your menu has some drinks that have been on for a while, and then, of course, you have some ones that you switch out, just like every place, right? I got three menu items that are always on.
I think so. I mean, I think there's some people that do these huge full menu flips, which we very early on found that was sort of against our philosophy, was we kind of wanted to really have drinks that were familiar to people. I have this theory of cocktail menus that the best menu is the one you never need to change.
I kind of subscribe to that too a little bit.
I never intend to change the menu, but also the menu's never going to be perfect, so you always have to change it. But
yeah.
So we end up switching up about half the menu, and there are a few drinks that have been on for a long time. Safe Cracker is one of Matt's. It's been on. And then the other drink we brought today is one of Allie's that has sort of moved into that headspace of being a drink we can't take off.
So we've talked about the ambiance and the experience that the guest gets as, when they come to the bar, but we didn't really talk about the drinks. What's the focus, Allie, of the bar's sort of message as far as what's going over the bar?
I want to make people happy with drinks. So like, we're in such a unique space that you don't have, like, the outside world at all. There could be 3 feet of snow, it could be 8 million degrees, and you're transported into something special. So, like...
Right, I think it's important to note that the up-and-up is semi-subterranean, right? You go down about 8 to 10 steps before you get in there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
no
windows. No windows, yeah, you're kind of in a bunker.
So a guest can come in and, you know, I want a Manhattan, and it's 3,000 degrees out with 100% humidity, but you're transported into a different space. So I think having a breadth of cocktails on is kind of cool. So a little something for everybody is my hope.
Yeah. You brought these. I'm assuming maybe they're the number one sellers. Maybe what do we got here? Or you just brought them because you know me?
I picked them.
They look like they're all spirit stirred cocktails.
I picked them, and I was just looking for something that would be really easy to do. Easy to bring from the bar, and then also something that would be representative of something that you can definitely find if you come to our bar.
Right.
And these are drinks that, like I said, they don't come off.
Yeah. How long is the menu? How many items?
20-something.
No, it's like 30.
It's 33, I think. Yeah.
33 cocktails on menu. And percentage, you said 90% of your sales are cocktails. Percentage of those that are on the menu? Or do you know?
I don't know. We do a lot of off menu. We have about 125 drinks that are in our old menu Rolodex that are things that have been on the menu in the past. We do make those, that's kind of our first line. When someone wants something off menu, we try to go to something that was from us. And then if we can't fill the need that way, then we go a step further away. So it's hard to say, but I would say that, probably 85 to 90% of that 90% figure is our drinks. Whether it's on the menu,
current or past,
it's a past menu drink.
That's incredible. Like, that's the goal. You know, I always analogize that it's, the bar menu is like the menu at the deli, right? They got a bunch of sandwiches listed there. They got a bunch of maybe special sauces, special bread. They know exactly how to make them, how quickly they can make them. They know exactly what it costs. But they also have all this meat and cheese, right? So it's like they want to drive you to the menu. Mm-hmm. And I love the fact that you want to not only drive them to the menu, but if they want to go off menu, you want to drive them to a past menu. Right, it's a drink you know it works. It's been tested. It's been approved. That's pretty smart.
Yeah, I mean, we have a.
You guys not drinking with us? You just made us one for each of us.
No bespoke cocktails. Nothing made that has not been previously made, tested, and gone through. Because you don't know, something might be great first couple sips, and after 5 minutes, it completely changes. And when we do a new menu, the first thing we do is we ask all the bartenders, "What's everybody asking for that we don't have?"
Mm-hmm.
And we use that as kind of our starting point to try and come up with stuff that will fill that.
Do you keep running tabs? You know, like, do you have like either a notebook or a digital place where it's like, oh, I got asked for, sotol again, tick, tick, tick. I got enough sotols, and now it's time to get sotol.
Not that specific, more,
it's a little bit more organic.
Yeah.
We do stuff like that at the bar as well. When we make a drink that hasn't been on the menu, we put that drink as a button in the machine with a count on it, and we count it down. From 150. Once we've sold it off menu 150 times, it's eligible to be on the menu. This does not mean that it will be on the menu, but now it's eligible.
That's a great idea.
Oh, yeah. That's cool.
You're welcome. This is delicious. That little tiny hint of green spice on the backside of this Negroni style cocktail is giving me a nice warm feeling. Let's talk about drinking, Chaim.
Mm-hmm.
You don't do it anymore.
Don't do it.
How long has it been now?
It has been over 3 years. It's been 3 years and 4 months.
And, you're one of the sort of like somewhat outspoken folks in our field who's a leader in not drinking. Like, your name comes up in these conversations all the time. I don't want to drag you out into it if you don't want to get into it right now.
But
how's that going for you? Do you get any? Give me the positives and the negatives.
There are definitely a lot more positives. I think that talking about either not drinking or choosing to drink less is a much more common thing in our industry than it was 3 years ago. I think that there's now a space at the table for non-alcoholic cocktails in a cocktail space that really wasn't something that was being talked about 3 years ago. As far as the positives go, you say I'm outspoken. I don't make a big deal about it. I mean, if people stop drinking, our bar would be out of business. So it's not what I'm, you know, I'm not looking to sell that. But at the same time, I think that there is a value to being in this industry and showing, hey, look, you can choose not to drink. You can be in this industry. You can be successful in this industry. And
you can be a bald barber.
And there's a way to do it. So, by putting yourself out there, it opens the door for people to come to you or to somebody else who also does this and say, hey, I need this. How is it that you do it? How can I do it? It certainly helped me knowing there were other people in the industry who had also made this choice, and I was able to talk to them about it, get my head around how it is that they do their thing, and then it helped me feel empowered, if you will, to go ahead and make that call. And at the end of the day, it doesn't really change what I do for a living at all.
Yeah, agreed. Well, maybe it does. I was about to follow up with, like, have you incorporated more NA or low ABV cocktails to the menu because of your, you know, stance? Or have you encouraged that from Allie?
I mean, there's definitely a plan to do that is not happened yet.
No, it's a goal, though, for sure. I think there's a lot of interesting things happening around it, and
sure. I mean, even going back to what Matt said, like, what are people asking for? I'm assuming they're asking for this because I'm getting asked for it at my bars, so I know that it's out there.
Yeah, and I think it, like, working behind the bar too, it gives you a little bit of a, like, because we don't do bespoke cocktails or anything like that, but we'll come up with something fun for you, and, like, to really personalize and craft something for somebody, I think is a really cool expression.
Yeah, you mentioned more than once. You don't do bespoke cocktails. What is that conversation like when you're talking to the guest? Because I get guests all the time that are basically just driving me to make them something.
Yeah, people think that's what they want, and they don't realize that it's not what they want. Yeah. But
how do you tell them that?
We're in the business.
Nicely.
We have to deal with other questions like that all the time. Like, people say, I don't want anything sweet, and we know that's a lie.
Yeah.
We know that's a lie. Now, we're in the business of trying to give people what they really want, not listening to what they do want. And what I've always told the staff is when someone tells you what they want, don't believe them.
Yeah.
Yep. You need to ask them what they like and get them to talk about things they've enjoyed. But if they come in and they say, I want a cocktail, not sweet, really herbaceous. I don't want it to be sweet at all.
Yeah.
Not sweet. You're going to bring them something they're not going to drink. So with the bespoke cocktail, they're asking for, they think they're going to get something better if someone made something up for them right on the spot.
Yeah, never. I disagree with that wholeheartedly.
Of course. But I think that oftentimes just getting the impression that a bartender has selected something for them based on their taste is enough to satisfy that.
Yeah.
And so, you know, our team, there's a certain point, Allie, would you say, where someone starts talking about something and when you're working the floor, you're working the bar, there's a certain point where you say, I got this.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And then you go and you pick something that was on a menu.
Sure.
And you make it for them.
Yeah.
And you tell them what it's called and you tell them what's in it. And some people, for them, that's enough. Some people mistakenly believe it was made up on the spot for them. But if that's what they want to think and that helps them have a good time.
I mean, that's
time,
part of the smoke and mirrors,
yeah.
Right?
Right. Yeah. Well, I think ultimately what those people want is they don't necessarily want to, you know, have it their way. They don't want the you know, what I call to Burger King it, which, you know, also, by the way, if you ever try to go and have it your way at Burger King, they will look at you like you have five heads. But that's beside the point. Like, I think what they want is not necessarily, like, to craft their own drink. They just want, like, someone to say, okay, I hear what you're saying. I hear this. I hear this. I hear this. I think this will be a special experience that is curated for you, you know?
They want individualism.
Exactly, yeah.
And at those prices, you know, why would you blame somebody? If you order an expensive steak, you want it cooked the way you want it. You don't want to just say, I'll just have the steak and do whatever.
Yeah, and you don't want it on, like, a paper plate either. You want to, you know, have someone come down, put it down in front of you, explain it to you, maybe crack some pepper on it by hand. I don't know, but you want, it's not just the flavor of it, it's the experience of ordering it. Right. Just
I suddenly get the sense that Greg has never been to a steakhouse.
And our staff is very good at what's more important than coming up with a brand new drink on the spot for somebody. They're very good at making the guest feel like they have taken the time to listen to what this person has asked for, listen to what they've said, thought about all the drinks available, and picked something that they think the person will like.
Yeah, and that all has to come back to training, right?
Yeah.
Let's talk about training. What goes on at the Up and Up? How do you train your staff, Haim?
Well,
because I remember you used to do a lot of fun stuff when you were at the Gin Palace next door to me at Amore Margo.
We
good thing this is radio.
You'll have to tell me about that fun stuff because I don't remember all of it. For training, I think the thing to put up front, and this is really strongly where Ali comes in on this also, because Ali does all of our behind the bar training. We don't hire bartenders. We made a decision a couple years ago where we were going to stop hiring new bartenders and we were just going to train from within. So everybody comes in as a bar back or a host and they work their way up. And by the time they finish bartender training, they've worked every position in the entire bar. So no matter what happens, we're flexible. People can work any station. And also they have empathy because when there's a new hire, they can guide that person through that process because they've worked their job. They know how to do it. They know how to do it well.
And they also have empathy for the fact that I can understand what you're going through on a busy time because I've been in that position.
Absolutely.
And I think that's huge.
For behind the bar, and Ali can speak more to this, but it's really a matter of untraining people from whatever they know before. But also, in a lot of cases, we've got people coming to us who maybe have never even worked in a bar before. Or if they have, they haven't bartended. So we're getting a chance to really, really make people our own and train them how to do things our way, 100%. When it comes to other aspects, the way that our door works is a really big part of how we do business. I am really focused on communication and how communication happens between staff and guest. So there's a lot of training about how to listen to people, how to ask questions, how to listen to answers, how to ascertain whether the information you've gotten from them is accurate and you can rely on it, and how to make people feel comfortable. And I think that a big part of the training is training people to be good communicators and empathetic to the people that they're talking to.
Where do you find your expertise in this that you can then train someone? What part of your background has given you all these tools? Is there a direct answer? Maybe there's not.
I mean, I think that...
You are a good communicator. I've always thought that about you.
Oh, thank you. I started thinking a lot about this years ago in bartending. Really, when I started working with Matt at Enoteca Liquori Bar, which is going back in our history together 10
2009,
years.
2009, yeah.
Over 10 years. I really started really wanting to pick apart, how come when I say this, a guest says this? How come when I do this, a guest perceives this? And the perception is never what I think it should be, and the response is never what I think it should be. And I started wanting to really play with that, and I actually played with it a lot more at Gin Palace in talking to people and the strange ways that conversations would go. And eventually, I really started to observe the connection between what people perceive and how they feel, and how can we, in the way that we act and the way that we talk about what we do, and even the physical qualities of the space, how can we better influence people to feel such a way that enables them to enjoy themselves more, if that makes sense. As far as expertise, I mean, dealing with thousands of bar guests and trying to pay attention.
Sure, yeah.
And now that I don't drink, I have a lot more time on my hands to, you know, really think about other aspects.
I mean, maybe at least you remember more.
Well, I wish that were true. But I don't work behind the bar anymore. I'm focused almost entirely on the front of house and especially working the door and talking to people on their way in.
Right.
And so whether that qualifies as expertise, I don't know. But I think that when you bartend for a long time and you pay attention to people, eventually you start kind of...
Some of it begins to finally sink in.
Ideally.
I mean, 20 years in, it's starting to sink in on me. Matt, what's your role on the daily? Are you on the bar, on the floor?
I'm mostly in the office.
Yeah.
I'm general manager.
Somebody has to take that role.
Yeah, I do all that. And I mean, in the beginning, it was sort of everything. Me and Haim did most of the menu back in the beginning. I bartended so many years back.
Mm-hmm.
But for me now, it's just kind of keeping the place physically together.
Yeah.
That's
a huge job.
Yeah.
It's pretty much thankless.
Yeah, it is.
So we're going to move right on. Allie. No.
Talk to us about the fun part.
I mean, that's a tough fucking job, and nobody likes to talk about it because it's kind of boring. But if without it, you disappear.
Well, it is boring, but it's also very rewarding because I've been in places where all the accounting and bookkeeping and all that stuff is done off-site, and you're just flying blind all the time. And it's really nice to be able to do it and be the one that does it because you know at any moment exactly where things stand, what needs to be done. But, you know, we always joke that the higher up you go in bar ownership, the closer you are to being a plumber.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You gotta have a big set of keys. And you got to, you know how to work every aspect of the mechanics of the place.
Mm-hmm.
I get it.
Keep a spare set of clothes.
Yeah. Keep the ice machine running. Always. Keep the toilet from being clogged up. Allie, let's talk about that training. So now Haim just told me you don't hire bartenders anymore. So you're getting people who've maybe never been behind a bar, and you got to look at them and say, I got a 33-item menu to teach you, plus probably a Rolodex of things you need to at least be aware of from your past menus. That's how I have to do it at Amore as well. Because people still come in 9 years later and order things from the first menu.
Right.
Right?
I think when you have someone who's super green, they don't have any bad habits yet, which is kind of an interesting thing to work around. You don't have to, like, untrain people how to, like, keep their sink clean and stuff. So that's kind of... That works out to our favor. It's really important to me to be able to be a mentor and to bring people up. I feel like, especially in New York, it's really hard... when you're first here to, like, break into the industry and get a job behind the bar. So this is kind of my way to give back a little bit in that capacity. But, yeah, I think the way we do it, everybody has such a working knowledge of the bar and the ins and outs of everything. After
sure, by the time they get there, yeah.
So that they're not surprised by anything. And then it just becomes the mechanics of it. And me yelling at people to keep the sink clean.
Well, and the nice thing about hiring from within is that, you know, if you, you know, maybe they've never held a jigger before in their entire lives, but they've been on the host stand for, you know, a couple of months, so you've been able to vet them and make sure that they're not, you know, an insane person or a werewolf, you
right.
know? Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, they're not going to flake out on you and not show up for a shift.
I think it builds, like, a passion for the place, and like you've put in so much work if you've started out on the door and then come in to be a barback and then, you know, go through training with me. You've put in so much time and
right.
so much work, and so I think it, like, I don't know, it builds a passion for the place.
Yeah, so by the time they get to you, they're invested personally yeah. in the space and their role there.
Right? Well, and the space itself, it's very success, right?
Mm-hmm.
What percentage, if any, of the folks don't want to shift positions? Does that happen? Like, does someone come in and say, I just want to run the door?
It's very rare. And if people come in saying that, at a certain point, they change their mind.
Yeah. They see the good of mm-hmm. of learning all these different things.
And to go back to what Allie said, I mean, being able to follow specs is about 5% of what makes someone a good bartender.
Of course.
All the other stuff you learn on the door, as bar back, dealing with people, dealing with team members, finding out how the place flows, how to help your fellow team members in need. That's what's important. And that's the stuff that we can see in people before we actually get them behind a bar. And we can tell, okay, this person's really, really got an aptitude for that.
Three of you sitting here, you're at the top of the house, Haim's the front of the house, and you're kind of the back of the house in this scenario. How many members on the team total?
11 right now.
Right, so it's still a small house, right, in the grand scheme of things. And everyone currently can do every job.
No.
But they're building towards that.
Yeah, exactly.
So you've got some people in the program who are maybe, I've only done the door so far, I've barbacked some,
right.
but I'm climbing the ladder.
And then we have three of our bartenders, including Allie, actually came on before we instituted that. So they were hired as bartenders.
Grandfathered in, sort of.
And then the rest of the bar team came on after that point, and so they've done all the positions.
Do you retro?
Well, yes, yeah, but you didn't get hired as a door person. No. You got hired to bartend.
Yeah. Do you retrofit those guys? Do you say, okay, you need to pull a couple of bar backing shifts, a couple of door shifts?
So you can have
that empathy.
Door was always a part of it.
Yeah.
For bartenders, they had to have a door shift as a part of their schedule. It's been that way since the beginning.
Right.
So it was no different for any of the bartenders that we still have on staff that were hired as bartenders.
Gotcha.
Barback was not part of that deal. So I mean, I think that at this point, Allie and I have both worked a few barback shifts by accident.
Yeah, when in need. We're getting towards the end here, but I'm just curious about this because I love this idea, but I feel like there are so many hurdles in the way just based on the way that people are. How do people feel when they have to get moved to a shift that maybe they didn't expect? Like tonight you're on the door. You're not on the bar.
Well, that only would happen if someone
sure
got injured or sick.
Yeah.
And at that point, I ask them.
Yeah.
I say, hey, here's the situation.
I need you to do this.
Can you do this? And
there's a lot of bartenders are kind of divas.
But when you have someone who's really invested in the team and they're invested in the bar and they don't want to let anybody down, I mean, in those circumstances, people say yes.
Yeah.
We're such a small staff too. Everybody looks out for each other like fiercely. It's really cool.
What's your attrition rate? You've been there for 3, you said,
mm-hmm.
Allie. You guys have been there from the beginning.
Yeah, not a lot. Really not a lot. Half of our bar team, I mean, Adrian and Peter have been there longer than you.
Peter started the week before me.
The week before.
And then Adrian started a couple months after me.
Yeah, so they're both coming up, all 3 of them are coming up on 3 years. And that's half of the bar team right now. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Pretty incredible. Guys, if anybody wanted to get in touch with you or find out anything about the Up and Up, where do they go?
Website's the best place.
Yeah?
Yeah.
What's the website?
www.upandupnyc.
Up all and up. Out. Got it.
All spelled out. UPANDUPNYC.
.com.
Yeah. Everybody knows how the internet works.
Yeah. Well, it could be dot. It could be dot org. It could be dot.
Yeah, right. Dot .edu. Net. Yeah.
Yeah.
Dot
.gov.
You know. Any social media you want to plug? You got an Instagram for the Up and Up, or for yourself?
Yeah, I mean Instagram. The Up and Up NYC. The Up and Up NYC, and that's where we're most active on social media.
Everybody is these days.
I mean, it's,
I don't even ask about the other ones anymore.
It's the best one.
Yeah, I mean, people, I always said Twitter is for your audience, Facebook is for your friends, and Instagram is for everybody who can't read. But your bar is beautiful, by the way. We didn't get to talk about that, but the design of the bar is very beautiful. You got that crazy wallpaper that you're known for. Mm-hmm. You had it custom made? Or you just found some cool-ass wallpaper?
No, no. Well, my wife, Tanya, is responsible for the interior design of the 3 bars I opened in New York, and she is a design historian. So she...
That's fascinating. Get her on the show next.
Yeah. Her her thing is always the kind of mix, you know, style. She's very good at knowing how to mix the styles. So the wallpaper is actually a William Morris wallpaper from 1892 that was actually going out of print for the first time since 1892.
Wow.
When we called them up and said, can we get some rolls of this? And they said, yeah, you better take them. We bought almost all of them. And then I'd love to think it was just because of people going to the Up and Up. But suddenly that wallpaper started showing up everywhere, and it's back in print. And
man, kept the streak alive.
Yeah,
there you go.
That's pretty amazing. Yeah, your bar is beautiful, and I'm overdue to come there. Al, you got an Instagram or something you want to plug real fast? No?
No.
She looked at me like I was crazy. Like I was at Burger King trying to have it my way. Well, guys, thanks so much for being on the show. Matt, Chaim, and Allie from the Up and Up. Really a great pleasure to have you on, and I'm way overdue to come visit you at the bar. Maybe as soon as my book deadlines are over, I'll be a free man again, and I can come out and check you out.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks for being on the show, guys. Cheers.
Thank you.
Cheers. Bye.
So you don't shun the devil with your rock and roll, Lord. Knows that country music's gonna save your soul. The devil runs his groove in them rhythm and blues that say.
The Speakeasy is powered by Simplecast.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork.
Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows that you like. Tell your friends. And please, join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.